We are slipping into darkness, into the darkest corners of ufology, stories about psychological warfare and paranoia and lies and disinformation. My guest, Mark Pilkington, author of Mirage Men, interestingly enough, as in addition to his writing, has been in a musical outfit called Disinformation. Great name for a band. When we come back, we'll get into some of the icons and some of the iconic cases of ufology, which might be, in Mark's view, the result of disinformation. And that includes the granddaddy of them all, Roswell. Stay with us on Coast to Coast. We will diverge a moment from our discussion about Rick Doty and disinformation and how Mark Pilkington, our guest, got on the trail of that story for just a moment to talk about some of the incidents and cases that are discussed in the book. Mark, I thought, I thought you gave sort of short shrift to a couple of these. One being that jumped out at me was the Iranian Air Force case from 1976, where these Iranian jets encountered UFOs and their weapons and communication systems were disabled. And I know you're not writing a whole book about that case, but you sort of brushed it off with a couple of comments that it could have been American spy planes or something that did this stuff.
That particular case, I mean, I know the case that you mean. I don't think I refer specifically to that one, but what I'm trying to show with the, and that's certainly a fascinating case in itself. I think it's not impossible that could have been some kind of sort of technological trickery. What I do look at is more recent to 2004. Sightings over Iran, over their uranium enrichment facilities, actually, that sort of sparked a kind of UFO flap throughout the country. And I did wonder whether this was a kind of deliberate ploy to kind of sow unease and fear within the Iranian people. And this was something that was actually mooted back in the 1980s as a ploy to destabilize the Gaddafi regime by sort of using technology to kind of fly ghost planes into the country and create kind of uncertainty and panic within the Gaddafi regime. So I wondered if there was some kind of parallel going on in Iran 5 or 6 years ago, and there are UFO sightings over the country still going on, actually.
Well, the Iran, maybe I misread this then, but that Iranian case is really a really good one. 1976, the documents were kept secret for a very long time, and it had to be squeezed out of the government. And while there may be technology where we can do this sort of thing to disable a warplane, that was Iran at the time was one of our closest allies. It would have been a pretty serious breach for us to mess around with their air force, especially since we had sold them the planes. And as I recall, there were witnesses in the air and on the ground that saw this gigantic UFO dancing around that coincided with what happened to the plane. So that's why I thought maybe you had given it a little bit of short shrift. But let's talk about another one. The Washington, D.C. overflights, 1952. Yep. And I had never read this before. I thought it was really fascinating. You talked about this weapon, this technology that CIA had at the time to create sort of ghost radar images, right?
Yes, exactly. And this was new to me until I started researching it and reading about it. And the I present as a possibility, as a suggestion, that famous July 1952 overflights over Washington, D.C. were the result of a demonstration, perhaps, or a test of a technology that would become very widely used, particularly by the CIA and the NSA, kind of in the 60s and through to the, I would assume, to the present, which allowed them to manipulate and plot radar paints on the screens of anyone.
In that case, then CIA would have pulled that on the Air Force without letting them know that they were testing it.
I can't say that. What I don't know is exactly who was using the technology. My sense is that it may even have been the Air Force themselves doing some kind of demonstration. I think it's very interesting that John Sanford, who was the head of Air Force intelligence at the time, and led the press conference. There was a huge press conference, the biggest since World War II to sort of discuss this these overflights. And Sanford kind of led these and talked about sort of radar confusions and things. And it turns out that he, 4 years later, became the second ever head of the National Security Agency, who were one of the sort of main groups to use this, this new technology. And the technology was sort of first stumbled upon by accident in, at the end of World War II in 1945, when the Navy actually became aware of sort of strange radar signals appearing on their screens in the Pacific, and they realized this was the result of having so many large radar sort of transmitters and receivers in one place. It caused those strange kind of ghost images to appear on their screens. And by the early, by the mid-50s, this technology was being used in the civilian domain to sort of train radar operators and pilots. So I don't think it's a great stretch to imagine that an early version of this was being tested in 1952. And there are other interesting tidbits of sort of circumstantial evidence, like one being that the radar operator at Washington, D.C. National Airport, who was kind of overseeing these overflights, became very frustrated and said on the record that he thought that whatever was on the screen was actually responding to his instructions and discussions with the pilots of the interceptors sent up to find them, and the pilots didn't see anything at all, and he actually sort of told the newspapers this. So, another person who was very frustrated by this whole incident was, of course, Edward Ruppelt, who was running Project Blue Book, the Air Force's official sort of UFO investigation project at the time, and he felt that he was kept at arm's length from this particular case, and said it took him over a year to piece together what he could have done in a few days if he'd been able to kind of get involved with the case at the very beginning. So it's quite a complicated story, I sort of tell it at that length in the book, but I think it's a possibility. The question why is, you know, something we can only speculate on, but and even who, but certainly the technology was there, and it would seem to fit the sort of the pattern and the signal that emerged from that particular incident.
And then we come to Roswell, and I realize, you know, you're not writing a book about Roswell, and gosh, you could write five volumes about it. And I am not a big supporter of any particular view on Roswell, because mm-hmm. in my view, it's become so hopelessly muddled that we're never going to be able to figure out what happened. And some of that is maybe by design, and some of it is the fault of various ufologists who've accepted different witnesses' viewpoints without thoroughly checking them out. I mean, we can't agree on what date the crash occurred or exactly where it occurred. Was it one crash or two? All that. But given that aside, you sort of brush off Roswell pretty quickly. And again, I realize you're not doing a book about Roswell, but you say, look, there's a case in Aztec that was a crash a couple years earlier, and it could very well be that this all stemmed from that, which I thought sort of ignores the statements of Jesse Marcel and then Walter Haught and subsequently his deathbed confession, things of that sort. I don't think that your view accounts for the testimony of pretty good witnesses.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. I appreciate your thoughts on that. I mean, what I'm sort of saying in the book is that there is a sort of there are precedents for the Roswell story as it emerged, and the thing to sort of bear in mind with the Roswell story is that for 30 years the Roswell story more or less, you know, didn't exist. Nobody from sort of 1947 till the late 1970s, you know, it was barely mentioned in the UFO literature and was, you know, was an obscure case, and then reemerged in the late 1970s thanks to research by people like Stanton Friedman and Bill Moore, who wrote the first book on it. You know, this then became a kind of almost like a Genesis myth for the UFO story. But one thing suggest as a possibility, something certainly came down at Roswell, as no sort of would seem to be little doubt about that. At the time, if the Air Force were trying to, or the Army Air Force were trying to kind of disguise the crash of something that was their own or was, you know, even somebody else's, but then perhaps spreading stories about a flying saucer landing, and it's interesting that the first reports describe a landing rather than a crash, may have been considered a kind of humorous and way to keep people away from the case. And of course, perhaps when someone further up the line sort of heard about this, they probably said, "Are you crazy? Do you, realize how how many people are now going to be flocking towards Roswell to make sense of this?" So then, a kind of contrary counter press release is put out, and the whole weather balloon story emerges. And so, yeah, it's just one of multiple possibilities. And I agree with you that I think it's impossible to kind of get to the nub of the story. Surprisingly, I actually have some, you know, I wonder if the Air Force's own explanation of it being a Mogul balloon might not be have some validity, although it's unfortunate that the first report that sort of presented the official Air Force line on the story in 1995 was actually written by one of Richard Doty's superiors at AFOSI. So you kind of get into a bit of a muddle there. But
yeah, Colonel Weaver, yeah.
Yeah,
I don't see how anybody can believe anything the Air Force says about this. I mean, how many bites do you get at the apple? You know, this is the definitive explanation. Oh, wait a second. We've got another definitive explanation. This is the final explanation. How many chances do they get?
Yeah. And I thought the second report that talked about the crash test dummies was just frankly bizarre. I can understand what they're talking about the sort of fallibility of memory and how certainly I understand how stories can change and evolve over time, but it was an odd decision to make to put out that.
All right, back onto the trail of Rick Doty and the Mirage Men. In the late 80s, I think it was 1988, there was a TV program that came on that featured two guests. Their names weren't given, but they had code names called Falcon and Condor. And mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen the entire program since mm-hmm. in your research. As you're tracking this down, did you figure that Doty was one or the other?
Yes. To be honest, I can't remember which one around it, but we know that it was certainly Doty and Robert Collins were the two men on the film. I'm pretty certain that Doty was Falcon and Collins was Condor, and they're obviously presented in a sort of blacked out silhouetted form that you can just about recognize. I could recognize Rick's voice sort of underneath the disguise.
And the story that was told in that is pretty much the one that that has been spread far and wide by various people, secret underground bases and aliens captured and recovered technology, right?
Yes, and live aliens being kept sort of at the U.S. government's pleasure in at Area 51 and other places. I mean, what's fascinating about these stories is that these are pretty much the same stories that were being spread by AFOSI and then sort of amplified and distorted by Paul Benowitz and others in the UFO research field sort of through the 1980s. And finally, they kind of pop onto mainstream television at the end of the 1980s and then sort of create another surge of interest and attention to the story. I can't speculate if that was a deliberate disinformation ploy or whether it was people having fun. I think the program itself was probably intended to attract viewers and make money more than it was to sort of sow disinformation. But I don't what the reasons that Doty and Collins were on there. I mean, we can speculate. But I'm not sure. But what's very interesting is the parallels, I think, with a story from the mid-1970s, and that which was the making of a film called UFOs, Past, Present, and Future by Alan Sandler and Bob
Robert Emmerich.
Yeah, and Robert Evenegger actually appears in the UFO cover-up live program telling his story. And they were, I think Bob Evenegger is sort of has sort of come around to believing in the sort of extraterrestrial story. They were certainly played a line back then and kind of, to a certain extent anyway, deceived into making a pro-extraterrestrial documentary film for the Air Force. And it's quite a sort of convoluted story in that, but they were fed false documentation and told, you know, exciting stories about UFO landings at Holloman Air Force Base and all the things that would kind of, you know, entice someone to make a film about the subject.
Of course, these guys using the Falcon and Condor, these bird names as code names, become sort of an infamous chapter in itself, in that introduces the world, at least the UFO world, to the concept of the aviary, this shadowy group. Some people think it's the secret control group of UFOs. Others, if you know who some of these people are, and I know to a couple of the members, or alleged members anyway, you realize that they're at least some people who have a legitimate interest in trying to get to the bottom of the mystery, as opposed to the people pulling the puppet strings, right? What's your take on the aviary?
I think the aviary sort of story is a sort of classic example of a sort of myth or sort of folklore emerging out of some fairly kind of mundane origins. But as far as I'm aware, the beginnings of the story were with William Moore, the UFO researcher, and his associate, Jamie Chandra, and they basically gave code names to a number of the sort of insiders in the military and intelligence communities who shared their interest in the UFO story, and they sort of began to give them all names initially based on the name of one of the informants that Bill Moore was speaking to, who called himself, or he was called the Falcon. And I think this might have something to do with a book called The Falcon and the Snowman, a sort of classic espionage novel from the early 1980s. But so this idea that there was, and these are real people, many of whom are still involved with the military and the intelligence communities, and they have, I think, for the most part, a genuine interest in the UFO subject. And I think it's actually, you know, I don't think there's anything particularly sinister about that interest. But, you know, I share it, you share it, a lot of us are fascinated by it. But certainly within those ranks are people who have and do sort of muddy the waters and spread disinformation and misinformation. I don't think these are the kind of people at the sort of seat of the UFO secrets. I don't think these are the keepers of the secrets. I think they're people who are pursuing those secrets in the same way that the rest of us are.
Yeah, and trying not to get fired at the same time.
Yeah.
I always thought it was interesting, and I know a couple of those guys pretty well and have great respect for them, but they've been blamed for all kinds of things, and people ascribe the darkest of motives and what they're really up to. It's interesting to me how they feel about Doty, who's using the Falcon name and going on television, has undoubtedly caused these guys a great deal of grief and professional problems, and probably got them called on the carpet with their bosses more than once. Mm-hmm. That he brought attention to the whole concept of the aviary, and yet they aren't ready to throw him under the bus. At least some of them aren't.
No, absolutely, and you know, there's a certain certain level of sympathy and understanding. You know, they're all to some extent in the same boat, although, you know, some of them are much higher up the chain of command, or certainly of the rankings than Rick is or was. So I think there's a certain amount of sympathy for his plight. You know, he also is just trying to make sense of a very, very puzzling and complex story.
Okay, we need to take another break. The song is appropriate, Dazed and Confused from Led Zepp. And if you're following the twists and turns of Mirage Men, you might be dazed and confused as well. When we come back, we get into some other controversial topics, SERPO, mutilations, crop circles, and a lot more on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Mark Pilkington, author of the new book, Mirage Men, and when we come back, we jump into a more modern controversy. It's called SERPO, and it's a wild one. Stay with us, everyone. Mark Pilkington, let's bring it up to more modern times. As you start getting hooked on this subject and you decide you have to go after Rick Doty, did you figure you would ever be able to sit down and talk to him?
No, never. Absolutely not. In fact, and I don't know if we told Rick this at the time, but we imagined all sorts of schemes that we might force our way to meeting him. Speeding through remote New Mexico and waiting to be pursued by patrol cars and things like this. But we got involved with a guy called Bill Ryan, who now is sort of quite well known in the sort of UFO world as a mouthpiece for all sorts of amazing stories. But back in 2005, he became kind of involved as the sort of front man for a very bizarre tale about an exchange of American Air Force men with extraterrestrial visitors in the mid-1960s, a story that became known as the SERPO affair. We got to know Bill, who lived in England, and he told us he was being invited out to be the guest of honor at the Laughlin UFO conference in Laughlin, Nevada, in March 2006. So we had really no choice but to go out there and follow him out there. And on the off chance, we emailed Rick Doty and said we're going to be out there making a film about Bill Ryan and SERPO, and will any chance you'd be there? And he was indeed, and we ended up spending quite a few days talking to Rick and hearing his stories and about his involvement in the UFO story. And we grew very fond of him, actually, much to some people's surprise. But
I think it's the best part of the book, as you guys are sharing your thoughts back and forth about what the heck is this guy up to? How much of this can we believe? And you're sort of mentally checking everything that he tells you to see if it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the big issues for anybody getting sort of deep into the UFO subject, as we did, is that of, you know, how do you separate the sort of, you know, the good information from the bad information? And that was actually a phrase Rick Doty himself sort of used, and when talking about one of the people he'd been feeding disinformation to, said, well, they had the choice of taking the good information, or they could have taken the bad information, and unfortunately, they took the bad information. And it often happens that the bad information is the more sensational information.
Well, it just so happens that you're pursuing this SERPO story. You're following Bill Ryan over to the States to watch him at this Laughlin UFO conference. Rick Doty is going to be there as well. You spend some time with him. And as you detail in your book, Rick Doty and the SERPO story sort of cross paths at some point. Why don't you bring us up to date on how that worked?
Yeah, that was something of a surprise. I mean, early on, when the SERPO story began to emerge through an internet mailing list, email list, and then later through Bill Ryan's own SERPO.org website, a number of characters have emerged from the digital woodwork and said, well, I can, you know, yes, I can corroborate this information. This is good information. It's stuff that I've heard before. And some of them claim to be DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, employees and insiders. But another one was Rick Doty, and that was really the first time he'd kind of emerged into the sort of public eye for a very long time, although there was his appearance on Coast to Coast, actually, with Greg Bishop for his book Project Beta. So Rick Doty was another person to corroborating the Serpo material, and he ended up writing about it for UFO magazine, and sort of, you know, being one of the at the time what seemed like number of people who said, yes, there's something amazing as this story sounds, there's something to it. Out at Laughlin, Rick and Bill Ryan were kind of clearly, you know, talking together and were sort of, you know, were friendly, and Rick seemed to have a key interest in Bill Ryan's presentation to the group. And one of the real sort of great moments for me was after Bill's presentation was kind of doing an analysis of it with Rick, who, you know, thought he did a good job, but had some sort of specific comments to make. And I suddenly at that point thought, well, he's taking a real keen interest, sort of almost like a forensic interest in the way that Bill is presenting this story. But later on, as it emerged, to sort of cut to the end, as far as we know, the sort of end of the story, a British researcher, Stephen Broadbent, who runs an excellent site called Reality Uncovered, through some, I think, quite lucky kind of digital cloak and dagger work, was able to show that the identities, or the digital identities of the people that have been corroborating the Serpo material, seem to share computers with none other than Rick Doty, and this was something of a shock and a surprise. And I don't think this is sort of conclusive proof that Rick was behind a lot of the Serpo material, but and it's certainly possible that he was kind of tricked into, you know, to being made to look like he was sending out these corroborative emails from false identities. But unfortunately, it doesn't look good. Good.
Well, just to back up a little bit for those not all that familiar with Serpo, this story comes out of nowhere. Victor Martinez, who's a guy who has this big email list that looks into lots of paranormal and UFO topics, in particular UFOs, starts getting it contacted by this anonymous source who offers to give this information. It starts popping up. And I remember when it first happened, I thought, wow, this is a great story, but I'm not buying it. And then a couple of weeks after a couple of months after the initial releases had come out, right in the middle of this thing, somebody puts out a poll and asks, hey, are you buying this? Basically, they ask all you people who are receiving this, do you believe it? It struck me as pretty obvious that somebody wanted to gauge whether this story was going over or not. And after that, I didn't give it much attention.
Right. And it's funny you should mention this idea of a poll or market research. That reminds me of way back in 1950, the first emergence of what became known as the Aztec UFO crash story. But when the first sort of lectures were given by an anonymous sort of doctor about this UFO crash, one of the first things that happened afterwards was that the campus of the university where it took place was suddenly flooded with Air Force officials who were conducting a poll on whether or not people who'd seen the lecture found it believable and convincing. So we have a sort of nice historical precedent for this there. But yeah, I mean, what the actual origins and the meaning of the Serpo story is still a mystery as far as I'm concerned. And there have been many suggestions from, you know, that it was all some kind of sort of sociological experiment to see how people respond to, you know, outrageous information, or even a way of sort of tracking certain ideas as they spread around the internet, or just the discovery of disinformation from another era that may have been sort of seeded by either side on during the Cold War. There are many possibilities, but it's a huge amount of data. You know, I certainly don't think one person sat down and wrote, you know, the thousands and thousands of words that comprise the Serpo material. Maybe it was some kind of experimental, you know, group authorship literary experiment. I don't know. But.
Well, that raises other interesting, tantalizing possibilities. There's a group that's working on it, or an organized group, or it certainly was an ambitious effort. I do remember that getting into this discussions, or at least exchanges, with both Rick Doty and Bob Collins about it, because as they were talking about things that happened at the Nevada test site and Area 51, these other unknown people, previously unknown people, came forward to vouch for parts of the Serpo story, parts of other stories that these guys had told about things that had happened in the Nevada desert. And those are the people that you reference in the book, people who no one could prove that they are actual people. And I guess the Open Minds folks, or Reality Uncovered, had seemed to indicate that at least two of these people seemed to have been made up. And the possibility was that they were made up by Rick Doty.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was alluding to earlier. Yeah. It looked like certainly they shared IP addresses with Rick Doty, which, and, you know, at the time, I remember, as you say, just sort of most of the names in the UFO kind of field are familiar if you spend enough time there. And up popped, was it Gene Lakes and Paul McGovern, and two people that no one had heard of before, and they're kind of claiming inside knowledge of what on the surface seemed to be this preposterous story.
Well, You spent like a week with Doty. Did you ask him? Did you make up this Serpo?
Oh, yeah.
Did you have something? What did he say?
What you would expect. He said it was, you know, the information was there, and as far as he could tell, it was genuine. You know, he was a careful guy. He's not sort of giving anything away. He certainly was. You know, he was taking a keen interest in the way that the Serpo material was being. Presented and spread by people like Victor Martinez and Bill Ryan. And actually, we, as well as meeting Bill, we did go and interview and spend time with an afternoon with Victor Martinez. And one of the things that really amazed me, which is just sort of coincidental, but I was surprised by, was that Bill had been involved in the sort of UFO scene in L.A. since mid-1980s, at least, and actually knew Bill Moore from that period. So there was a sort of another connection between Rick and the Serpo material, even if a kind of a distant one. But
well, you also looked at other parts of Bill Ryan's background, and it seems like everybody's got some sort of a intelligence or government connection somewhere back along the line. And I seem to recall that at that Laughlin conference, that was some sort of a staged, orchestrated event where Bill Ryan was handed some secret packet of information. Do you know about that?
Yeah, we were actually there at the unveiling. I think I helped open the envelope. That was a strange scene where I think we were. John Lundberg and I were with Rick Doty, and Bill Ryan emerged with a manila envelope with green name sort of addressed to him on the front. And we opened it up, and it was filled with the kind of strange symbols that looked to me a little, sort of little like maybe Korean or something. But they were sort of obviously intended to present some kind of strange alien alphabet. And also some new extracts from the sort of leader of the Serpo Expedition's journal. And these appeared, I think, the day before Bill's presentation to Serpo, and there was a whole kind of strange sort of complication where he'd been given these documents but then was told, and I don't know exactly who told him this, that he couldn't present them to the conference and had to sit on them. And one of the things that was, you know, no fun for us was to see that Bill Ryan became, you know, quite distressed and quite stressed out as the time of his presentation sort of loomed. And I don't think that was just sort of normal nerves of pre-speech nerves. I think he was being kind of buffeted around by different forces within, you know, within the UFO community present at the conference, and seemed to get quite confused and concerned about what was going on.
One of the things that jumped out in your discussion of Serpo in the book, jumped out to me anyway, was the discussion about how the emergence of Serpo coincided with the explosive growth of two major paranormal conspiracy sites online, Open Minds and then Above Top Secret. And I thought it's almost sounded like you're implying that maybe they had something to do with it, that they were created to be vehicles for spreading this story.
I wouldn't sort of say that. Certainly wouldn't say that explicitly. I mean, I think, you know, the way culture works, things that it's always about call and response and, you know, information feedback loops. And the Serpo story certainly led to a huge surge of interest in what until that time, so 2005, had been a largely sort of dead subject. I think there were actually newspaper reports about the death of ufology. I actually chaired a sort of panel discussion at the Fortean Times convention, I think 2004, called, you know, Is Ufology Dead? And then Serpo came along, and now, you know, what, 5 years later, the subject is once again sort of, you know, it's hugely popular. There's a new surge of films and TV series kind of being prepared. So I think, you know, Serpo hit a nerve and really sparked something off. But one of the things I do refer to, and sort of certainly with a sort of, you know, question mark alongside it, is the idea that these forums like Open Minds and Above Top Secret certainly prove kind of useful kind of nodal points for drawing people interested in UFO research in, and that's actually one of the recommendations as far back as the Robertson panel report to kind of, you know, focus people's interest in areas, you know, physical meetings and groups and conferences that make monitoring them much more straightforward. So certainly, while I couldn't say whether those sites were set up for this purpose, certainly they do serve that purpose. And it's interesting that around the same time, early at first part of the this decade, a web forum set up to exchange stolen credit card details was actually infiltrated by the FBI and became a kind of, you know, a giant fishing net for them, and resulted in 60 arrests, I think it was.
Oh, I'm sure that all kinds of people troll those sites for information and to sort of monitor to gauge the pulse of the public on these kinds of topics. I just know that ATS, and Mark Allen has been my guest on the program. I know the guy really well, and I know that he created that site as a business enterprise to make millions of dollars if he could. And I think he was probably happy that Serpo came along if it generated that kind of interest. But it's a pretty big site. It's awfully big right now.
Yeah.
Here's before we take this break. You know, the book details how Bill Moore was sort of sucked into this thing with Doty. He spied on UFO people in exchange for the promise of information. And Linda Howe, to some extent, was helpful in that. And Doty has weaved these webs over the years. Some may be true and some may be not true. And he's an interesting character. And here we are. You follow him down this path as well. I think at the end of the book, you mentioned that he had sort of held out the promise of good things to come. It's almost like, you know, you followed the same path that Bill Moore and some others have followed, and I wonder if it's obviously had to occur to you, am I being manipulated as well?
Yeah, and this was something that we were constantly asking ourselves, you know, and to some extent we sort of deliberately, you know, almost offered ourselves up as bait in the sort of hope that we might get drawn in.
Get recruited?
I don't know about getting recruited, although some people have suggested I work for British intelligence, but I don't think I would meet their stringent acceptance standards. But no, certainly we were aware of this issue, and there was a point actually where, and we have no idea to this day, John and I, whether this was, you know, a game we were being played sort of in another game, but where we were told that, you know, we would, our documentary might be funded by the U.S. government if we, you know, if we presented the right material within it. And, you know, nothing came of this suggestion, although we were so given contacts and names of people who appeared not to exist and when we tried to chase them up. So,
well, Mark, we need to take another break. I'm sure we can get into that in a little more in the last hour that we have, and we'll be opening up the phone lines. People can call in with their questions for Mark Pilkington, author of the fascinating new book called Mirage Men. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.